I'm actually technically not from the University of Vienna. I realize there are multiple affiliations, so it's easy to get confused. But it's Ekoki Vienna, which is technically a separate research institute, private thing. But anyway, so thank you all for coming. Thank you, John, for inviting me. This is my first time at Perimeter. It's a very cool place. I like it a lot. So this talk is based on this paper, which on this screen is entirely illegible, but that's not doesn't really matter. The main purpose of this was to highlight my colleagues, but since you can't see them, I'll say their names. This is Shishir Kandelwal, and this is Misha Woods. So basically this talk is an advertisement for this paper, or a summary thereof. So I invite you to go and read it if you're interested. So what I'm going to do is talk briefly about operationalism, which people seem to use to mean a few different things. So I've picked my own random definition of it, and then I'll stick with that. Then briefly talk about how time is seen in general relativity and our view of it in quantum mechanics. And then using this operational view, I'll describe how we set quantum clocks in the curved background, and then hope to convince you that in doing this, we can demonstrate a kind of new quantum, a new kind of time dilation of a quantum origin in addition to the relativist, standard classical relativistic time dilation. And then finally, mention how the consequences this has for the precision of the clock. Okay, so, there we go. Operationism. In this context, when I say operationalism, what I mean is that a concept, we define a concept by the set of operations by which it's measured or determined, which sounds, depending, sometimes I hear this statement and it sounds strange, and sometimes I hear it and it sounds kind of tautological. But it's really, I think, from what I kind of hear, I probably don't have to convince too many people in the audience of this, but maybe I should go through it anyway. This is really how standard quantities are defined, like in the SI system of units, for example. You know, a meter is defined operationally. It's defined as you need some kind of clock, and you say, I measure the distance traveled by light in 1 second, and then divide that by a fixed number. You know, so taking this idea and applying it to the notion of time, we come to the conclusion that time is that which is measured by clocks. This view, this idea of operationalism, is really nicely discussed in this textbook way back when. So first of all, a few words on time in general relativity. So if you look at Einstein's early papers on the subject of relativity, you see that he is kind of using an operationalist approach implicitly. He discusses, he says things like, let each system be provided with a rigid measuring rod and a number of clocks, and then discusses the properties of those things. So really he's defining the notions of length and time with respect to the things by which you would measure them, which is operationalism. And in fact, this textbook, which I talked about here, he discusses Einstein's work as a kind of prototype of operationalism. So the usual view of time in general relativity is it's something that's associated with the world line of an observer. You have some world line C and this function here that you integrate along the world line. Sometimes I hear people say that time is a dynamical variable in general relativity. I don't think that's not how I understand it. I would say that the metric is the dynamical variable, and then that then determines what kind of time you'll see in what kind of circumstance. But this is a point-like trajectory. It's well-defined. You know, this is a time, and this is a spatial coordinate. And of course, in quantum mechanics, we don't have these things. So what do we have in quantum mechanics? Well, time is usually treated, when I say quantum mechanics, I mean standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But mostly what I'm saying, it would also apply to field theory. Time in quantum mechanics is usually treated as this parameter for the evolution of your state via the Schrodinger equation. And then you can say, well, since other observables in quantum mechanics are represented by operators, can there exist a time operator? This is a question that a lot of people have asked for a long time. There's a lot of discussion on, but even as far back as Pauli in the 30s, I think. So if we wanted to construct an operator that represented time, that is some system that we will observe and whose outcome we will define as the time. Let this operator be represented by this by t sub c. If we want this thing to be a time operator, it somehow has to track this Schrodinger time, this parameter t. And as a consequence, that means we need this commutation relation with the energy of that system. Now, unfortunately, modulo certain technicalities, this implies that your Hamiltonian has to be unbounded below, and therefore you have access to a perpetual motion machine, effectively. You have an infinite resource of energy. So that rules out the existence of a time operator. But there's kind of some kind of contradiction in this. If we've said that we're defining time as that which is measured by a clock, and now we've just said that no clock can ever measure time on average. So what do we do? Well, what we can do is say, given a finite energy system, how well can it function as a clock? How well can it approximate this kind of idealized clock? I should say that this is a definition. I'm going to keep using the word idealized, and I mean a clock that has this commutation relation. So given some generic system, we have the thing we're going to measure, the rule for its evolution, and the way we're going to initialize it. We can define this error operator e hat here, and we call this the error operator because now if we look for the average of this time operator, we see that it tracks the Schrodinger time, the extrinsic time, whatever you want to call it, plus this quantity here. So if your error, the trace of your error operator is very small, then you have a good clock. You can never have an ideal clock, but you can have a good clock. So I should probably keep running out of time. Yeah. So taking as an example this Salico-Wigner-Perez clock, which is a common, it's like a workhorse. Whenever someone wants to talk about a quantum clock in the literature, this is one of the kind of easy ones to whip out. And the way this works is that you have d evenly spaced energy levels with a spacing omega, and you find some time states as a sort of like a discrete Fourier transform of the energy levels. So you know, if you initialize, say in the 12 state here, your state will evolve to be very uncertain. There will be a lot of coherence in this time basis before refocusing on the next time state one, and then the next step will be the defocusing again, the spread, and then refocusing again on the 2 state, and so on and so forth. So if you measure this clock at the right time, you get the right time. If you don't measure it at the right time, you don't get the right time, generally. So this has an interesting property of being depending on when you measure the time, either you will have perfect precision or very bad precision. And the argument goes, as you increase the dimensionality of this clock, the spacing between these gets smaller in time. So your clock will measure the right time more of the time. That makes sense. And so kind of as d goes to infinity, this should somehow approximate an idealized clock. But there are some issues with this. I mention it just to go on to define what's been called the quasi-ideal clock. So this is the same physical setup, with the exception that you now start with some coherence in the time basis. You start with a Gaussian superposition of time states. And now what happens is your Gaussian superposition will just evolve neatly, just rolls along. So you now have a kind of continuity of your time measurement. And you can show that as the dimensionality of the clock increases, you can make this Gaussian tighter, and this error operator that we defined before, although the authors of this paper don't do that, but if you calculate it, you see that this error operator is exponentially small in dimension. So we can't have an ideal clock, but we can have a quasi-ideal clock, particularly as the system gets larger. Okay, so now if we want to talk about time dilation, we have to somehow include relativity, right? And we do that by first considering we're going to use a classical background, so no quantum gravity, nothing so special. In fact, everything from here on will be like the most basic level theory. In fact, we use a post-Newtonian expansion, so that's to say weak gravity and low velocity metric looks like this. Hopefully this is familiar to you. And we use this common approximation of the Newtonian potential around a point, which yeah, I'm sure everyone remembers from the, their first year of undergraduate physics or even earlier. So given this metric, if you have some slowly moving clock with initial velocity v0, initial position x0, and you define two frames, one the kind of lab frame in which the clock is moving, and the other which is the clock rest frame, of course, in which the time will be the clock's proper time, then the times of the two, the times of those two frames are related to each other in this way, which again should be relatively familiar to you. Okay, now considering the four momentum of the clock, what we're going to do is equate, we're going to describe the energy of this, sorry, I should start again. Now if we consider the four momentum in these two different frames, the norm of this is a scalar, so we can equate them, and then rearrange to get the energy of, in the lab frame as a function of the energy in the rest frame and its motional properties and the gravitational potential. So now if we assume that the clock has some internal energy, some internal structure, sorry, which it kind of must have if it's going to function as a clock, it needs to have some kind of dynamics and therefore some kind of energy that will actually be used to track the time. Then just by mass energy equivalence, we can write the rest energy as its rest mass times c squared plus the energy of this clock dynamics, whatever those are. So what we're going to do is take this expression and quantize it with, under the assumptions that I already mentioned, low velocity, weak gravity, and also this that the rest mass energy is much larger than the energy that's going to be used to measure time, which again, I think is a relatively reasonable assumption. This procedure is actually not mine. It's following Magdalena Zitsch, as outlined in her PhD thesis. So then after quantization, we arrive at a bipartite Hilbert space. One is the kinematic center of mass motion, degrees of freedom, and the other represents the internal clock degrees of freedom. So promoting these energies to Hamiltonians and then the positions to position operators, momenta to momentum operator, et cetera, we arrive at a total Hamiltonian that is the free Hamiltonian of the clock, how it evolves such that it will track the dynamical parameter t. It's kinematic degrees of freedom. I mean, kinematic is perhaps a misnomer. I'm including the potential and the rest mass energy here. And then an interaction term. So it's pretty intuitive, if the clock is going to somehow, if the state of motion of the clock and it's the gravitational field that it's experiencing is somehow going to imprint on the time that it measures, then of course you need to couple the clock space with the kinematic space. For the sake of including everything, these are the terms that we're neglecting. So this is, as I said before, this is weak gravity, low speed, and the rest mass energy is much larger than the energy of the clock's dynamics. Okay, so now, given this setup, we can ask what time on average does our clock measure when undergoing some given state of motion. So the game is we have some quantum system, we initialize it in a certain state, we leave it to undergo some evolution, and then we measure whatever we've defined to be the observable that we're going to use to track the evolution of time, and ask what on average do we measure for that, given some initial state of motion and state of the clock. And the answer to that is this. So before, way back when I defined this error operator, there was a little subscript nr. I should have said that is there to denote non-relativistic. So that equation that I had before is this part here. And then we get plus a time dilation. And rather neatly, this separates into this function r of t, which is just contains all of the kinematic dependence, all the dependence of the state of motion and the gravitational potential that the clock is experiencing. And then very nicely, this the dependence of the actual particulars of the clock factors out like this. So there's one plus the trace of this error operator. So for a good clock, this part is zero. And if I want to convince you that I'm of this operationalist approach, that I'm considering clocks, I say that something happens to the time that they measure under some circumstances. You could always say, well, it's just an effect of the clock, perhaps. How can you be sure of that? Well, this separation is quite nice because I can, like, this is the part that depends on the particulars of the clock, and this is independent of that. So let's consider an example. So if we take the state to be initially in a classical state of motion, that is to say Gaussian, particularly this wave function in momentum space, we see that the time dilation we measure looks like this. Now, if you have a good memory, you might see the resemblance between this and the time dilation I showed you, the classical time dilation I showed you before. If we go back to that formula and say, now let's just consider some classical clock, which is following a distribution of momenta and position, if I consider a classical clock whose initial momentum and position are distributed according to some classical Gaussian probability distribution, then on average, this is the time that I'll measure. So now if we go back to this and set trace of E equal to zero, so this is quasi-ideal clock, for example, then we see that we have exactly the same expression. So this is a good sanity check. Like a clock that's undergoing a classical state of motion will read classical time dilation on average. This is in contrast to a claim in a recent paper that said the title of the paper is something like classical clocks do not witness relativistic time dilation, and they do. I'm misrepresenting the claim of that paper slightly. The title is hyperbolic, and there is a point. So now we've considered this kind of sanity check, a classical state of motion. Now let's consider a non-classical state of motion. So we take a kind of, depending on who you ask for the definition, this may be called a Schrodinger's cat state, but in any case, a superposition of two classical states, a superposition of two Gaussians. This should be pretty self-explanatory. We have, they both have the same width, and they're just separated by this distance. We take the superposition with parameters, with coefficients root of alpha and root of 1 minus alpha. Now, to separate out what's quantum from this, we want to compare this to a classical mixture. So if we now consider a state where we just mix with the same probabilities the states, we will find in that case we'll have, as we must, due to the linearity of the trace and the expectation values, that it's just alpha times the expectation value of one of the classical states plus 1 minus alpha times the other. But then, given this formula, we see that, again, there's a neat separation. If there's the time on average measured by the superposed clock is the classical, that measured by a classical mixture plus some coherent term. A term that arises from the coherence of the state. And that has this ugly or neat form, depending on your aesthetics. Why do I call this coherent? Well, I mean, I could just say, well, one's a mixture and one is a superposition, and therefore, but actually there's a very nice, this whole thing is, you can see part of this, wait, how exactly should I say this? So this statement is proportional to 1 over the overlap of these two wave functions. So this gray area here. So what that means is there really is interference in this area, and that's what's giving rise to this. Sorry, that's what's giving rise to this part. So I'm really whizzing through this much faster than I expected. The last time I gave this talk, it took me about an hour to get here. So I don't know how it is in Canada, but I think in the UK, if in a court of law somebody is silent, it means that that can be taken for agreement. So I don't know whether I should apply the same rule here, or if maybe you're just more disciplined than the last audience I had. But that was a kind of quantum time dilation. Now I promised to talk about how relativity affects the precision of the clock. Generally speaking, under unitary evolution, If I start with some uncorrelated initial state of a general bipartite system, it will only typically remain in the set of separable states under one of two conditions. Either if the eigenstates of the total Hamiltonian are separable, or if the initial state is particularly mixed. Well, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian that couples the center of mass degrees of freedom with the clock degrees of freedom are not separable. So as long as we don't start in a particularly mixed initial state, we should expect to evolve into correlated states. That is to say, entangled states in this case. So intuitively, you can then see that if we are only going to consider the clock, only going to consider the clock subspace, the time measuring subspace, I should say, then some of that information that's encoded, that the temporal information is going to have leaked into the position momentum degrees of freedom, and that will cause an increase in the uncertainty of the clock. So that's what we're going to quantify now. So just straightforwardly calculating the standard deviation, one finds that it is equal to the standard deviation in the non-relativistic case of the observable t, plus a term which remains in the case of an idealized clock or a quasi-ideal clock, and a case which only depends on the parameters, the specifics of the clock. I should note that, sorry, I didn't say that to make this calculation tractable, we've ignored gravity, so it's just a particle moving in free space, and that it's necessary to go to one higher order of precision in order to do this. So yes, this is the expression for this part that it remains in the idealized case. As I said, there's this other term here. I flash this up just to show you that I have calculated it. It's an ugly expression, and I don't see any interesting physics coming from it. So from now on, we'll just ignore it. So now if we consider the idealized clock or the quasi-ideal clock, in that case, the standard deviation of the time observable is independent of time. So we see here that the uncertainty of the clock is going to increase quadratically with the time, regardless of the initial state, at least to the approximation that we're using. So given that I've described this as a leaking of information from one space to another, a reasonable question is, can we recover this information? So we consider a coarse-grained measurements of momentum in that kinematic space. That is to say, a set of projectors defined by the width of the binning, the bin size delta p. So as delta p tends to zero, this becomes an infinitely precise measurement. And as delta p tends to infinity, this becomes the identity operator. And so it's as though no measurement has been performed. And then we ask, what is the uncertainty of what is the standard deviation of the clock time after you've performed this measurement? So doing this numerically, we can see in the case, as I said, the case q goes to infinity is where you've performed no measurement. You've recovered no, sorry, I should say before discussing this, that this graph is conditioned on obtaining the most likely outcome. Yes, so the case where, sorry, should also say, I've defined this parameter q, which is the ratio of the bin size to the standard deviation. Because the more spread out your wave function is, the amount of information you gain depends not only on your bin size, but also how spread out your wave function was. Yes, OK. So in the case where this ratio goes to infinity, that is to say no measurement has been performed, we have the greatest standard deviation in the clock time. And then as we shrink the bin size, you can see that these curves are closer and closer to this blue curve, which is when q goes to zero, that is to say an infinitely precise measurement. And in that case, we recover all of the lost uncertainty. We've recovered all of the information. So it's relatively intuitive, I think. So the conclusion is as I... The conclusion was the premise.
So you mentioned this as a relativistic.
Yeah.
How do I see it's relativistic?
Naively, because it depends on 1 over c, on a power, sorry, on an inverse power of c.
If I study a narrativistic clock, this term will be completely absent.
Yes, well, I mean, depending on your definition, perhaps, I would describe the non-relativistic limit as the limit where C goes to infinity. You derive relativity, or special relativity, at least, by stating that the speed of light is the same in all reference frames. The speed of light is finite, and that any sort of causal information has to propagate with a finite speed. So as you increase the, as you take that speed to infinity, you're removing that kind of causal restriction that separates Minkowski space from Euclidean space.
Okay, so I guess fixed size ago, we have three terms for the signal.
Yes. Yeah.
In a non-relativistic case, the uncertainty completely resides in.
Yes. Yeah. That's why this is the NR subscript.
This is the
non-relativistic component.
Sorry.
No, problem. No worries. It's good. No, if it's not clear, then it means I haven't explained it. And this is it. For a general clock, this is time dependent, but for an idealized clock, or the quasi-ideal clock, this is independent of time. Right, yes. And in fact, that was it. So, in summary, good clocks experience classical time dilation on average when their states of motion are classical. But then if you consider a non-classical state, this may result in a quantum contribution to the time dilation, which is a consequence of the coherence of interference between branches of the wave function. And also the coupling that causes that time dilation also entangles, in general, the clock time with its motional state, bleeding temporal information into the kinematic degrees of freedom. This is interesting because normally you would say that the precision of my clock depends only on the properties of the clock. You might be tempted to say, well, I need to know where the clock, how the clock is moving and where it is in a gravitational field in order to take into account the time dilation. But this is, I'm saying precision here, not accuracy. Those things will result in a systematic bias, but they won't widen your uncertainty, which is what's happening here. Yes. So then there's a to-do list. One is to translate this into experiments to ask what does it mean to superpose a clock? What kind of systems could we consider this? Why is there any way that we could observe this, or is there any, or can it be somehow? Can there be sort of a more general consequence of an additional quantum time dilation that one might consider, as opposed to just literally trying to see this number? Another is to look at the case of recovering the clock precision in a, or the increase in the clock's imprecision, and then the recovery of that lost precision when the gravitational field is non-zero. Can we still recover all of the lost precision in that case? What kinds of, how does the necessary measurement basis for recovering all of that information depend on the whether or not you include gravity? I'm guessing that once you include that position coupling term, perfectly precise momentum space measurement isn't the right thing to do if you want to get all of that information back. And also, the analysis is slightly incomplete in the sense that this graph was conditioned on only obtaining the most likely outcome. That needs to be re-examined. So yes, just to say again that this was an advertisement for this paper, or a summary of this paper, and to emphasize that this was work done in collaboration with Shishir Khandelwal and Misha Woods. And thank you for your attention. Any questions?
We have plenty of time for questions, so.
Do you have any estimation for the order of magnitude you have to compare with the experiment?
So this is a very reasonable question, and in fact, the first thing someone should do. The issue that I have is that being quite divorced from experimentalists, that makes it sound like we had a fight. I don't mean it like that. I mean being quite separate from experimentalists. I could just throw in some numbers, as I have done, and get really quite large magnitudes for this coherence effect. But then if I were to then report those to you, I would be being disingenuous, because I don't know what reasonable numbers are. I don't know what kind of parameters are this, even close to being achievable in the lab. It's trickier than you might think. Because let me go back, maybe. If I go to this. Yes. So the separation of the wave functions, which is this parameter, my guess is that the wider your separation of wave functions that you can stably achieve, the smaller the time for which you can perform the experiment. In general, the more, the less classical your state, the more fragile it is somehow. So this is one of the key trade-offs that I don't know how to model. So the next step is to go around knocking the doors at the doors of multiple experimentalists and saying, "Hey, I have this result. Can you help me make sense of it in real terms?"
There's a recent, I think it's published by Joseph Samuel and a couple of other people, who were looking at quantum effects on the precision of clocks and gravity.
Oh, really?
And they have none.
Do you know the context in which their results are, or do you know anything? Can you tell me anything more?
Only that it was something to do with gravity, specifically to do with gravity, in the presence of gravity.
Okay. The name was Joseph Samuel. Okay. Thank you. I'll look that up. Thanks. Anybody else?
Yet again, you said that the coupling of the internal kinematic degrees of freedom, at least increased uncertainty in time, could not be understood classically because there is a systematic deviation.
I didn't mean that. Well, I should be careful. I don't know if I used the words "cannot be understood classically," but what I was referring to in that case was that I find the results surprising because intuitively, the time that a clock measures might depend on where it is and how it's moving, but not the uncertainty not the uncertainty in the clock. So, you know, there's a difference between precision and accuracy. This is the distinction I was trying to make.
I thought you were saying something about that. Yeah. I don't understand why that ought to be the case, because I have in mind the following example, where I feel like even though everything about this example is classical, it should increase my uncertainty about the time. So if I had like a pendulum clock, mm-hmm. and so the strength of the gravitational field will determine mm-hmm. here to that clock. And so maybe I started out and I know precisely what time it is. It's I have very little uncertainty about the time. Mm-hmm. But I do have some uncertainty about, say, where it is. And like, imagine I'm projecting it. And So you know, my uncertainty in where it is will determine now an uncertainty in, you know, its trajectory through the gravitational field, and therefore uncertainty in exactly how many ticks it's mm-hmm. done. Because, you know, one possibility is that it went low, another possibility is it went high, and you know, the number of ticks will depend on that. So it's at the end of the day, my uncertainty in where it was will convert into an uncertainty about what time it is.
Yeah.
Not a systematic bias, but an uncertainty. The spread in possible times will increase, but it's not by virtue of coherence. It's just by virtue of my initial ignorance and the fact that the time couples to the spatial location.
Yeah. So my reply to that would be, if you consider, I haven't done this, but if you consider a kind of delta function as an initial state, I think it should be the case that starting in a separable state with a well-defined, even if you start your clock sort of on average fixed at a well-defined position, and in a separable state with regards to the momentum and the clock spaces, then this will still evolve to a entangled state, I believe. And in that case, you'll still have an increase in uncertainty due to that, even though you were totally certain of the spatial position at the start. The issue with this is that as soon as you're totally certain of the spatial position, you're totally uncertain about the momentum.
I don't see why that ought to be true, because classically, again, if I look at the joint distribution over the kinematics and the internal degree of freedom, mm-hmm. I could start in a product distribution. Mm-hmm. That just happens that, you know, on the kinematics, I have some uncertainty about where it is in space. But that's not correlated at all to my state of knowledge about the internal degree of freedom. Mm-hmm. So it could be like certain about what time it's showing and a bit uncertain about where it is in space. Now I evolve, and although it starts in a product distribution, it evolves into a correlated distribution because the time it shows later depends on where it's
going. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes.
Wouldn't it be linear increasing uncertainty? And here they have quadratic.
Yeah.
Would it be a linear increase
in uncertainty? So it seems like the deviation would increase linearly.
I don't see why it would be. Like if the dynamical evolution is like a chaotic motion, for example, and I imagine that
I think
strong increase in uncertainty.
I think you're right. There's something I haven't considered here, which I need to consider. The effect will still be different than the classical case because you have this back reaction that shouldn't be the case in this kind of classical scenario that you're painting. These two distributions, you'll end up with correlations, but you won't have a kind of back reaction on the state, classical state. There's no kind of coupling of the. Let me start again. The kinematic degrees of freedom will simply evolve according to their own rules, and the internal dynamics of the clock won't affect that to first order, ignoring sort of perturbations of the gravitational field due to the energy of the clock or something like this. So there will still be a difference, but I think you're right that the statement that you would not expect an increase in uncertainty is not true.
Can you go deeper into why you think back action is the difference?
Because the dynamical equations for the position momentum phase space don't have any dependence on the time that the internal. If I can describe the center of mass motion of a thing as a I can describe any complex system as a kind of point particle with the same properties as start this sentence in a way that I can finish it. I can consider some complex system and take its center of mass motion and simply describe the position of momentum of that as I can ignore the interrelation of the parts. You know, is that making sense?
The Hamiltonian you wrote did involve a coupling between the internal and the kinematic, so seems to me that the internal degrees of freedom can influence the kinematics of that Hamiltonian.
Yes, in this case, yes, that's what I'm saying. That's why I think that's what makes this, or would be one thing that makes this distinct from a classical case.
But I can have a classical Hamiltonian that does exactly the same thing, which seems to me the appropriate thing to compare it to. And therefore, classically, I would expect to also see a back action of internal degrees of freedom
in kinematics. You can construct a Hamiltonian that would do that in classical mechanics. But here we are forced to do that. There's no reason why you have to. And in general, if I have a wristwatch floating around in space undergoing some dynamics, unless the energetics of the internal mechanics of the wristwatch are particularly strong, then this will just be, I can treat this to all intents and purposes as a point particle moving around. As long as I'm, you know, ignoring collisions with something that where the spatial aspect of it might be important. But generally the dynamics at the center of mass motion of that object will not depend on the how it ticks. Unless it's emitting something or unless, you know, but.
I'm still failing to see a difference because I could say, well, quantumly I can, if I want, decide to model something as having no interactions between the kinematics
and
degree of freedom.
But,
and I can also do that classically. And in both cases, I could choose to model that. So I still don't see the difference.
Yes, but this is what I'm saying is if you want the motion of your quantum clock to affect the time that it reads, as you must if you want it to, you know, experience time dilation, then there must be some coupling in that sense. Whereas in classical mechanics, there's no reason for us to have that coupling. I'm not saying that in the mathematical structure of classical quantum mechanics, there's something different here. I'm saying that the dynamical rules force us to do this here, whereas they don't necessarily force us to do that in classical mechanics. We can arbitrarily choose to do so. We can try to construct a scenario where that's the case, whereas here we're forced to make that to be the case.
You're telling me classically, if I want to see time dilation in a clock, I'm not forced to presume that the internal degree of freedom of the clock couples to the kinematical degree of freedom? Because intuitively it seems to me I am forced to do that. If I imagined as a Hamiltonian that the internal degree of freedom is totally independent of where the clock is, then I would thereby be saying I cannot model time dilation in this model.
But normally you're yes, okay. I didn't think about it in trying to operate, like trying to make an operational theory of time in classical mechanics, then okay. Then what you're saying might be the case.
The specific reference
to coherence was an earlier part where the coherence impinges upon the time dilation experience, not the uncertainty. I didn't specifically frame the increased uncertainty as a consequence of the Hamiltonian coupling of the center of mass and the clock degrees of freedom. I didn't explicitly frame that as a coherence effect because if I were to make a statement like that, I would want a piece of mathematics to back it up. And
The quantum uncertainty is more than it would have been.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yes, yes.
I'm just trying to put
that's right, yes.
that into words. So it should be quantum interference effects.
Well,
that's just the way I'm thinking about
What I was saying was...
Maybe we could take an analogy and see if that's... Suppose you were just thinking of spreading of a wave pattern. And start with some Gaussian wave pattern with three non-relatives to particles. You could try to compute its spreading in two different ways. You could say, classical. In this case, I don't know that there ought to be a difference between the quantum and the classical. But you could say, well, because of the uncertainty principle, there's some initial uncertainty in its momentum. And then from there on, and there's some initial certainty in its position. And from then on, everything is classical. It just moves. Mm-hmm. Follow straight line paths with given velocity.
Mm-hmm.
You could ask how the spread of the wave packet evolves with time. You could see whether or not it evolves more rapidly, whether it gets bigger.
Yeah, that's.
Quantum case. I mean, is that an example of the distinction that you're trying to draw?
That's not what I was talking about, but that would be another way of. I'd like to calculate that. That's an interesting question, but what I was talking about specifically was an entanglement that's generated between, if you start in an uncorrelated state, an entanglement between the internal time measuring Hilbert space and the center of mass degrees of freedom. And I made a...
You said something came out bigger than you were expecting. I thought you said that in conclusion. Maybe I just didn't.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what you're referring to, sorry. I don't know about... Well, yeah, I made this statement, I realize now too hastily, that you wouldn't expect an increase in your uncertainty.
That's it.
Not knowing the position and momentum of your particle, but now, given this discussion, I realize that I need to go back through that. But I would be surprised if... given that there are correlations that are allowable in this case that aren't allowable in the classical case, I would be surprised if if you can always find a classical version of the example being considered, or if you can always say that the result is the increased uncertainty is the same as if you simply took a classical distribution of position and momentum that you didn't know.
Maybe you should compute some Dirichlet entropy between the two. I mean, trace out the one in degrees of freedom. See whether it's greater than. I don't know exactly, but there must be tests. Maybe there must be another test whether a correlation is quantum in nature.
Yeah.
Or whether it's
yeah.
Just the disinfectant.
Sounds quite reasonable. Yeah.
I'll comment on that. If you do comparisons between the quantum case and classical probability distributions, the results can sometimes come out opposite way to what your intuition might suggest. So, you know, nice example is tunneling. If instead, you know, so if I look at the expectation value of energy of a particle coming up to a barrier that's at a higher potential, then, you know, I might say classically I expect nothing to get through, and therefore the quantum effect is that something got through. But if instead you say, well, let me use a probability distribution over momenta whose expectation value is the energy, because that's really what the quantum wave packet ought to be compared to. You know, its mean energy was this. Well, there's a classical distribution whose mean energy is that, and it has a spread of energies. Mm-hmm. Well, then I see stuff getting through, and so the tunneling phenomenon is not surprising. But what I actually see is anomalous reflection, because the wave properties of matter will set up a resonance with the width of the barrier and the wave function. And so what's surprising in the quantum case is that you get surprisingly less tunneling than you would have expected for the corresponding classical distribution.
Hmm.
So all this to say that it's not obvious whether, you know, the real quantum effect should be more uncertainty or less uncertainty or something else. I think you need to really make the comparison of the classical distributions carefully to see
yeah.
what kinds of differences you find.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks.
So you mentioned tunneling. That's what I wanted to ask you. I always thought a very interesting problem is, so to be very far from any classical distribution, but a clock that tunnels under a barrier,
mm-hmm.
what does it read when it gets out? Do you have the technology for answering that?
I think so. I mean, it's very easy to say, I can calculate that, and then not calculate it. But I don't see any reason why I couldn't do that. This is an interesting question. Yeah.
I mean, there's two extreme points of view. One might say, but when it's under the barrier, it's completely non-classical. It loses all its properties as a clock. Who knows what it is?
Mm-hmm.
The other point of view is, well, it's a certain time between when it enters and when it enters. Why should it, assuming it's not so big compared to the width of the barrier, that its internal function is completely disrupted,
mm-hmm.
why should it not continue to read the correct time?
Well, my intuition is that before you hit the barrier, you're rotating. I mean, like a unitary evolution is just a rotation in the degenerate subspace of the Hilbert space, in this case, bipartite. So before your clock is hitting the barrier, or when your clock is not, should I say, or maybe it is trickier than I thought. But intuitively, without a barrier, you're simply rotating in this degenerate subspace in the center of mass energy and the clock energy and this coupling. And then with the inclusion of the barrier, this is an inclusion of a constant term in the center of mass degrees of freedom. So then you're kind of somehow changing the angle slightly of that rotation, the angle of that sort of slice through the Hilbert space in which you're rotating. And then on the other side, you're going back to before. So I would expect, with this naive picture in my head, an initial state that's rotating will land somewhere else than it would have done otherwise, even if you're considering the internal space. So it should.
So you think it'll mess up the clock completely?
I don't know about mess up the clock completely, but it will change the clock time non-trivially, I think. But again, it's very easy to say things and then not do the calculation.
I mean, what it's going to do is reflect back and forth, like Rob was saying. On an indefinite number of times, finally.
Sure, but
true. So that.
But as long as it's not in a Gaussian state, then there's some non-classical time dilation that it's experiencing. So it seems from what we've done. And so I think it won't just be a matter of sort of considering the average number of reflections inside or before it exits or something like this, and then on average that's what it. That's the extra sort of time dilation of the clock, or the extra time experienced by the clock, I should say.
I'm thinking if you can ask it as a non-relativistic question. I'm not worried so much.
Yeah.
The
Well, in a non-relativistic case, in the non-relativistic case, you have no reason to couple the center of mass degrees of freedom and the clock degrees of freedom. So then the whole theater of the particle motion and the barrier and all this stuff is happening in one space that's completely disconnected from the space that's being used to measure the time. So in that case, you would expect nothing to happen.
In that case, you expect the clock to be a true clock.
Yeah. I mean, as true a clock as a quantum system can be. The beginning of the talk was giving some caveats as to how to do that. Any other questions?